Thank you so much to everyone who submitted a question. I'm going to start at the beginning and get through some, probably not all of them. And then I ask that you think about the questions, not only my answers, but what do you think your answer to the question might be? And then we'll try to save a few minutes for congregational response, where maybe you can take a crack at them and expand to my answer, challenge it, tell us what truth you would make out of the question. So we'll start with one of these small detail questions. Is there an afterlife? If I had to answer briefly, my answer would be, I don't know. And since it's my service, I get to add a little bit to that answer. I don't personally think that there is an afterlife, although I do sometimes find myself both comforted by ideas of the afterlife, and that sometimes the way that other people talk about it or the way that I read about it, it stirs my imagination and helps me to be a better person here and now. And in a way, that's the kind of afterlife that I do believe in. I believe that our words and our spirits and our legacies live on, and sometimes they live on in really evident, obvious ways, like I could tell you a story about my grandmother and how she was thoughtful and how she influenced me in profound ways. But I also really believe that some of the ways that I am able to experience success, contribute to love, revel in beauty, that those are also legacies of people who maybe I can't name and never knew personally, but I believe very strongly in legacy, even as I don't know what happens after one dies. I haven't ever experienced that I know of. It's a good question. What does the divine feminine mean to you? I believe that the divine, that the spirit of life, that God is big enough to encompass all genders and even no gender. I think that the divine is beyond gender and also includes it. And for me, and this is a personal answer, as are all of my answers today. So I invite you to think about if your answer might be different and know that I celebrate that might be true. But for me, a feminine divine is about a deep connection to relationship. I think that people of all gender value connection and value relationship. And I think in our society, it's often been feminine and womanly people and ideas that have explored our co-creative connections most deeply and have been able to live them out most authentically. So to me, if I think about sort of honoring or channeling divine femininity, it's about some thread of connection, whether that's connection person to person or connection to planet or spirit or some other form of life. Are the Gen X, Y, and millennials going to be able to keep the fellowship going with their time, talent, and financial backing? You know, this is a really good question, and if you don't mind my broadening it, I think it's actually a really good question to ask about people of all ages, generations, and life stages. We know that economically, in the last few generations, we've experienced a lot of upheaval, especially among some economists, instead of talking about sort of the middle class as a framework, are instead talking about the stable class, people who come from situations where they're able to look at the last couple generations and their family and predict and forecast that certain th- threads of stability will continue. So whether that means being able to afford dental care, home ownership, there's sort of different markers of stability. I don't know if those are the ones that economists who are interested in this language use, but those are some ways that I think of stability. You know, could my grandma afford to get her teeth repaired? Did my dad get dental care? Can I afford that? Can my kids see a dentist? Might their kids be able to? And we just know that economically things are really changing, and they're not changing for the better. The difference between the haves and the have-nots is widening in this country and globally. I think that's a problem. I think that that's leading to suffering. And I do think that it's putting religious institutions and nonprofits in a situation where we know that if we're going to survive, things are going to have to look differently. And so counting up time, treasure, talent, all of that is going to have to look different. And I don't know that I'm not saying that it's going to have to be worse or that it gets to be better. But I know, as someone who grew up Unitarian Universalist, I know that the challenge for me is to be really open to change. And even good change is hard change. So I think these are wise, big picture questions to be asking. Oh, this is a good polity governance question. Why wasn't a quorum stressed at the annual meeting? So our annual meeting is when members of the fellowship get to vote on the budget and other issues that impact us as a community. And a quorum means that we have a large enough percentage of our membership present, as that's defined in our bylaws, in order to actually conduct business. If only two members showed up, we wouldn't have quorum and we'd have to go home and figure out how to get more people at the meeting. So those of you who are at the annual meeting, you arrived and you saw that board members were stationed at tables to check you in. So what happens when you get checked in is that you get a ballot, but the board member also recorded that you had arrived and checked in. And so at that point, we were able to assess, well, are there enough people here to call the meeting and to make the decisions that we needed to make. So typically, at a business meeting, if you haven't made quorum, then that's when you have to start talking about it. Cake versus pie, which is better? Usually I don't wade into such controversial theological controversies, but I'm going to be bold and say that while I do make an excellent pie, I would usually prefer cake. Somehow I thought someone was going to, shout something, but. And then their follow-up question is, what is the meaning of life? I think the meaning of life is to make meaning out of life. And that's a collective and a very intimate task. If you had the chance to go to Vietnam, would you? Yes. Contact me after the service if you have an extra ticket. This is a two-part question, so I'm going to read the whole card and then talk about it. How can I best have conversations with people I disagree with? Also, am I doing a disservice to my fellow LGBTQT people by not being out? I'm scared to be out. Thanks. So the first part of the question, I think that being in conversation is really an art. It's not always easy to converse across difference. It's easy to shout slogans. It's maybe even easy to talk, because I can talk at someone and they can talk at me, and that's pretty easy. You could even just do it at the same time, and no one has to listen, and it's very efficient. But if we're talking about an actual conversation, I think it's hard, but the practice that I always try to remain faithful to is to really summon my curiosity and to really listen. And I've found that I can be really clear that I may or may not agree with someone, but I might be able to learn something. And there are a lot of subjects on which I'm not open to changing my mind. If you wanted to have a conversation with me about if it was okay to kick puppies, I don't think it is. I wouldn't be open to a new perspective that would change my mind about that. But I would absolutely be open to why you think it makes sense to you and what in your life caused you to arrive at that conclusion. And I think that the way that I try to sort of be anchored in curiosity across difference is to ask more questions than I make declarative statements, and then to also be really clear with myself what my bottom lines are. That there are certain times that a conversation might feel toxic and it's not kind or helpful for me to be a part of it, and that's okay. I get to have my own limits and my own boundaries. So I think if a conversation feels like an assault, then I would offer to you that you might want to think about it as toxic and not a helpful dialogue. As someone who is out and gay, I'm out, I'm queer, I think it's really, really, really important that people who might be GLBTQ and don't want to be out in public about it, I want you to know that I consider you my family, and I don't think that you owe it to me or to anyone else to language or live your life in any particular way that doesn't feel right or comfortable to you. I think that I do celebrate the bravery of people who are able or willing to come out, and it's easier to do that publicly. But I celebrate the courage and the integrity of people who, for a variety of reasons, might not feel safe coming out or might prefer to not do so. That's what it means to live in a society with liberation available for all, that we get to make our own decisions about that. And I think that that applies to queer issues. And I also think it's really cool when people will say, like, I struggle with addiction, I have a learning disability. These are all brave ways that we come out about who we are. And I also think that you might have a learning disability, you might have kicked a heroin habit. You don't owe it to me or to anyone else to say that. And if you'd like to reflect on that in a slightly more personal situation, I'm always up for an appointment to just chat and listen and believe. Okay, I'm going to answer one more question, and I want you to know I'm going to read all of the questions that I didn't get a chance to answer, and I save them. Usually at least once a year in the program year, I preach on a service that was inspired by a question that we get at our question service. So please know that I really appreciate the questions I didn't happen to pull out of the pile. So this last one is, how do you follow the first principle in these horrible times filled with horrible people? So the first Unitarian Universalist principle is the inherent worth and dignity of every person, that every person has value. And I believe that. I believe that each person is valuable, even if everyone's behavior is not good. But I find it not very instructive. So I believe that. So what? I find our second principle that calls for justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. A lot of people are now trying to expand that to be justice, equity, and compassion in all relations so that it's not just about human-to-human contact. I find that a more helpful principle because that instructs me how to behave. Whether or not I think it's a horrible time or you're a horrible person, I can behave in a way that offers you justice, equity, and compassion. And unfortunately, I have not yet figured out how to control other people's behavior. I'm a parent. I'm working on it. I haven't. but I can try to be in charge of whether or not I offer compassion to people and whether or not I always think about justice and how that is or isn't being lived out in the situation. And so, oh my gosh, these are all really good, you guys. Okay, I'll do one more. What do you do to make sure all the women ministry staff is fully attentive to issues impacting men of the fellowship? This is a really good question. So I think that, sort of in the theological sense, I think that all of us need to be attentive to all of our needs. So that's the collective theology piece that I think is really beautiful and difficult about Unitarian Universalism. And then institutionally, if you look at the org chart, you have a ministry team who's definitely willing to be extra in charge of organizing that for people. And I think that it's a really big change that we don't talk about a lot, that now 100% of your ministry team identifies as female and is on the younger side. We're both under 40. We're both women. And that's a change for both of us. Neither Reverend Christina nor I have ever served on an all-female ministry team, and that is a change for some of you. Maybe some of you have been in congregations where there's an all-female ministry team, but a lot of you haven't, I know. And so I think it's really important to look at, like, what kind of programs do we offer? And so I think that some of the spiritual work that we do here and some of the leadership development and some of the core commitments of our congregation, like blessing our babies, thinking about a theology of curiosity, offering programs that inspire the mind and deepen the heart, I really hope that these are relevant to people of all genders and that men feel included and challenged and comforted. And if anyone of any gender has, like, an idea of how we can do that better, let's have that conversation. But I really want to talk about how important it is for people to have, like, space-segregated time. I really believe that sometimes we're better participants in the collective whole if we can have a little bit of identity-specific time. So that's why we have a group that's specifically for members who identify as people of color. For the people in our community who aren't white, to have a chance to be together and to be mutually supportive as they're part of the larger whole of the fellowship. That small group is, I think, meeting after the service. So if you identify as not white and you want more information, find me, and I don't have the room memorized, but I can help you get there. And so I think it's really important that you know that there's a men's group at the fellowship, and that it's a chance for people who identify as male to be with each other in deep and thoughtful ways. Is there someone here who attends that group who'd be willing to just wave a hand so that if someone was curious? So Dave Gerlach, George Geiser, I might be, Dave Wallace, are all people who are a part of that group and would be happy to welcome you, give you the spiel about what happens, and invite you to have a chance to just be in a community of men, if that would be helpful to you.